you've got to have a real blockbuster results to get yourself in a position to keep going forward, and they didn't have that.
As Shell's drill rigs head south, a look at why the company pulled out of the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unusual number of dying otters wash up on Ketchikan Bay beaches.
Something is hitting them harder and faster than, in addition to the disease that we're familiar with seeing, something else seems to be involved.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Shell's Arctic oil rigs have left the Arctic. The two rigs pulled into Unalaska's Dutch Harbor on Sunday, more than 1,000 miles south of the company's drilling site in the Chukchi Sea. They're now headed for Washington State. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
The rigs started on their way south after Shell abandoned its 8-year, $8 billion quest for oil in the Arctic Ocean last month. Shell spokesperson Megan Baldino says the rigs are refueling and making crew changes during brief stops in Dutch Harbor. Before this summer's unsuccessful drilling season, Shell contracted with Seattle's Foss Maritime to store its rigs at the Port of Seattle in the off-season. That plan met resistance from kayaktivists on the water and lawyers in the courts. The remaining legal hurdles to berthing the rigs in Seattle evaporated in recent weeks. On Monday, a King County judge ruled against environmental groups in their lawsuit against the Port of Seattle. They opposed the drilling because of the twin risks of spilling oil in the remote Arctic Ocean and fueling runaway global climate change. Megan Baldino with Shell says the rig's final destinations are still being determined, but they will not be returning to Seattle. The Noble Discoverer is headed to Everett to offload equipment and supplies. Baldino says two tugboats will bring the Polar Pioneer to Port Angeles on the Olympic Peninsula. When a single tug towed Shell's Kulik oil rig from Dutch Harbor to Everett in 2012, the rig broke free. It ran aground during a winter storm in the Gulf of Alaska. The Kulik wound up in a scrapyard in Asia. Baldino says Shell has incorporated many, many lessons from its 2012 program. She says safety is Shell's first priority. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
When Shell announced it was pulling out of the Arctic for the foreseeable future, it surprised just about everyone. Many in Alaska had high hopes for offshore drilling, from an Arctic economic boom to more oil for the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Shell's announcement left the state wondering what to blame: low oil prices, tough regulations, or better prospects elsewhere. In other words, is it us or is it Shell? From the Energy Desk, APRN's Rachel Waldholz went looking for answers.
Kara Moriarty heads up the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and she says it's kind of us.
I think we have to ask ourselves, why did it take so long?
Why did it take 7 years from when Shell first bid for leases in the Chukchi Sea to when it finally drilled its Burger J well this summer? Moriarty blames the slow pace of federal permitting and a thicket of regulations.
We can't control the geology. We can't control the company's decisions. But what we can control as Alaskans and Americans is to make sure that we have the right policies in place.
And she thinks we don't. That is also the view of many of Alaska's elected officials. But the real story is likely more complex. Shell declined an interview request, but in a statement, the company pointed to three things. First and foremost, the Burger J well itself.
The killer was the results from the well.
That's oil and gas consultant Brad Keithley. He says if Shell had found the elephant field it was hoping for, red tape probably wouldn't have been an issue. But
with declining cash, with increasing costs, you've got to have a real blockbuster of results to get yourself in a position to keep going forward, and they didn't have that.
In its statement, Shell said it found indications of oil and gas, but not enough to justify further exploration. Keithley says we'll never know exactly what they found. They'll keep that information close, and perhaps dust it off 5, 10, or 15 years from now if they ever decide to return. Another issue Shell cited was, yes, a challenging and unpredictable regulatory environment.
I would agree that there was a challenging regulatory environment, but that was absolutely essential.
That's Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society. She points out that many of the regulations Shell faced were put in place after BP's 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. After that disaster, she says, it was clear there needed to be more stringent rules for the Arctic, where a cleanup would be much more difficult. But on one point, she does agree.
The regulations that are in place are appropriate, but they do make things a lot more expensive.
That's the third issue Shell cited, the sheer cost of the project. Over the years, costs and delays added up. There were delays after the BP oil spill and litigation over the Chukchi leases. Then in 2012, Shell made a series of missteps that culminated in the wreck of its drilling rig, the Kulik, off Kodiak. Here's Keith Lee again.
Shell was down to one hole. If there hadn't been the delays, if things had gone better, frankly, if Shell had done some things better and oil prices, they'd been able to get out there before oil prices collapsed, they might have been able to drill more wells. And frankly, they might have found that their second or third location was the one that had the oil.
As it was, Shell ended up drilling its first well in 2015, with oil prices hovering around $50 a barrel. And during the years that Shell spent navigating the challenges of the Arctic, other opportunities had opened up. Opportunities that weren't even on the horizon when the company first bid for leases. New technology unlocked new and cheaper resources.
Additional opportunities like shale, like offshore Brazil, offshore Africa, the Gulf of Mexico have opened up in a way that have made the Arctic less important in terms of that new frontier.
Shell's decision is part of a broader trend. In just the last 2 years, Chevron and ExxonMobil shelved offshore projects in the Canadian Arctic. Exploration off Greenland ended in 2012 after disappointing results. And Shell itself has other balls in the air. It's in the midst of a $70 billion deal to acquire the British company BG Group, which comes with offshore assets in Brazil and a focus on natural gas. So is this the end for offshore drilling in Alaska? Keith Lee says yes, for now.
Shell put its best foot forward. I think the industry is probably uncertain about where to try next.
Or when they might try it. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
Two Alaska state troopers hired in September 2013 to reinvestigate the 1997 John Hartman murder case testified in state court in Fairbanks on Monday. Jim Gallen and Randy McFerrin took the stand during day six of a month-long evidentiary hearing prompted by men known as the Fairbanks Four, who claimed they were wrongly convicted of Hartman's beating death. Among numerous issues addressed was a 2011 memo to Fairbanks police from a California prison guard sharing information from inmate and former Fairbanks resident William Holmes, claiming he and a group of high school friends, not the Fairbanks Four, are responsible for Hartman's death. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The 2011 Holmes confession that's become central to the Fairbanks Four post-conviction relief filings was not promptly acted on by Fairbanks police. Trooper investigator Jim Gallen testified that the memo was not included in the department's Hartman murder case evidence record, but he found it in January 2014 while going through a box of case interview tapes at the station.
Inside of it was this memo that I had not seen before.
Gallen said he was surprised to find such an important case document stashed in a file.
We had not seen it before, and it would have been nice to have it.
Gallen said he asked longtime Fairbanks Police Lieutenant Jim Geyer about it.
Geyer looked at it and said, about that time, Detective Thompson walks in. He says, Detective Thompson is good at finding these things on the internet. I believe he found it on the internet. Thompson seemed confused, kind of nodded in agreement, and we didn't pursue it anymore.
Former FPD Detective Chris Nolan testified last week that he let the Holmes confession memo languish on his desk for 2 years, but gave it to Lieutenant Geyer in September 2013 when the Fairbanks Four filed their suit. How long the state knew about the memo is also at issue. Gallen said state prosecutor and assistant attorney general Adrian Bachman refused to release email communications about it.
I recall Investigator McFerrin asking access to these emails, and Ms. Bachman told him we were not getting it.
Gallen testified that the 15-month investigation of the Hartman murder case was incomplete when terminated by the state in January of this year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the trial of a hiker accused of springing lawfully set traps along a trail.
When you set off that marten trap right there, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking about?
That I didn't want one of my dogs to get caught in that trap while I was working on getting the eagle out.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Scientists continue to see large numbers of dead or sick sea otters turning up in the Kachemak Bay region. Officials with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service say the agency has received about 200 reports of sick or dead otters over the past few months. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
It's Friday night, and Mark Weber with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Homer has already had two calls for sick sea otters.
Well, I just was out on the spit having dinner with my family, and a call came in as I was coming into the station of two otters ashore on Mariner this evening.
Weber's part of a group trained to respond to sick and injured marine mammals. He's deputy refuge manager for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which runs the Alaska Islands and Ocean Visitors Center in Homer.
And so I was able to get to one of them down below the rock wall along the spit road. And that individual was in very bad shape. It is a somewhat depleted condition, but demonstrating something we've also seen a little bit of, which is kind of a set of neurological symptoms where it was twitching.
Weber and trained volunteers try to keep people away from sick otters and get a vet to euthanize them when necessary.
We're finding otters all over the Homer area. They're found from outer Bishop's Beach all the way around the spit on both sides and along the shores of Mud Bay, so pretty widespread.
Otters play an important role in their habitat, Weber notes. They're positioned at the top of the food web, so when something's going wrong with them, something is likely affecting the entire ecosystem. Otters were nearly hunted to extinction during the fur trade of the 1700s and 1800s and suffered again after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The sea otters in Kachemak Bay are part of a population that stretches from Cook Inlet to Prince William Sound. In the 70s, the Marine Mammal Protection Act safeguarded otter populations. Otters remain protected. At last count, the Kachemak Bay otter population was around 5,900. Carrie Gertz is a veterinarian with the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. She's been examining sick otters.
This summer started off fairly typical with a couple of otter carcasses being found, a few otter carcasses being found every week. However, as the summer went on into August and September, we were getting up over 20 carcasses or moribund animals each week. And it's in those animals that we've seen some different presentations.
She says they've been tracking a streptococcus illness in Kachemak Bay area otters for some time, and those otters usually appear sickly and emaciated. But the otters that have died since August seem different.
Most recently, what we've seen more of is animals in a healthier condition that seem to have been taking care of themselves well, but have died acutely. And that seems to be, that had become more common in the ones that we've been seeing in the last couple of months.
Weber with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Homer says he's responded to around 50 calls for dead and dying otters over the past couple of months, and what he's seeing seems different than what he's seen in the past.
Something is hitting them harder and faster than in addition to the disease that we're familiar with seeing, something else seems to be involved. This is just speculation. We don't have any evidence of that yet, but that's what we're seeing on the beach.
Officials with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Sea Life Center say they're waiting for lab tests to get back in the next few weeks. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Monday's small claims case between a trapper and a trap springer was supposed to last an hour, but after about 2.5 hours in district court, it's stretching into a second day. Juneau trapper John Forrest is suing hiker Kathleen Turley for springing his lawfully set traps on Davies Creek Trail. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
John Forrest said on the witness stand he's suing Kathleen Turley because the state dropped its case against her in January.
I want her to realize she did something wrong. that was against the law. And my thoughts are, if the prosecutor had done his job on the first go-around, we wouldn't be here wasting our time and more money. What she did was wrong. She had good intentions.
Alaska wildlife troopers had originally cited Turley for hindering lawful trapping, which carries up to a $500 fine and 30 days in jail. Forrest, a 55-year-old Juneau resident, makes his living chopping firewood and, less substantially, trapping. Forrest estimates he's owed $500 to $750 in damages. He's been trapping for about 45 years and says his traps have been destroyed or stolen numerous times.
Kind of puts a sour taste in your mouth when you put all this time and effort into something and somebody comes along and fools around with it. It's, kind of like going out and setting your string of crab pots and going out a week later and two of the pots are gone and the crabs have been taken out of the rest. It's like, what the heck am I doing out here?
Forrest has a three-mile trap line near Davies Creek Trail. On December 27th of last year, he said three of his marten traps were sprung, two box traps on the ground, and one trap that was in a bucket hanging in a tree. He reset them. On his way out, he found one of the ground traps and the one in the tree had been re-sprung.
And never in my life have I had to reset the same traps twice in a day due to human interaction. That yanked my chain.
Aside from these three traps, two others targeting wolverine had been sprung as well. These two had caught a bald eagle. Forrest calls that the ugly side of trapping.
It's kind of like fishing. Most of the time you catch what you want. Sometimes you catch something that you don't. And it's not something that I look forward to. But it happens, and it's part of the whole trapping thing.
Turley had come across the eagle 3 days earlier when she was scouting the trail with three dogs. The eagle was still alive, and she attempted to save it. She tied up the dogs and sprung another trap that she says was 10 feet away. Her lawyer, Nick Pulaski, asked her about this.
When you set off that marten trap right there, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking about?
That I didn't want one of my dogs to get caught in that trap while I was working on getting the eagle out.
It took Turley an hour to free the eagle out of two traps. As she was walking out with the eagle, she says she sprung another trap on the ground.
I grabbed a stick as I got close to it and then, leaned over and tossed the stick in the trap as we went by because I knew I could easily keep my dogs under control as I was doing that, but I didn't want to go past the trap and have them, one of them break control 20 feet later and run back to it. I didn't want to deal with trying to get another animal out of a trap that day. It was almost dark by then.
Turley is an avid outdoors person and a hunter. She raises rabbits for food and is not opposed to trapping. Forrest's lawyer, Zane Wilson, questioned Turley over the phone. Turley admitted springing two different traps, one on two separate days.
Did the thought ever cross your mind about the impact you'd be having on a trapper when you're out there springing their traps?
No.
Because you don't care about the impact it had on the trapper?
The safety of my dogs and my group were foremost in my mind. I didn't think about what effect it would have on the trapper.
And the safest thing for your dogs would be for you to leave them at home, correct?
Safest thing for any of us would be to stay at home all the time and never go anywhere.
That last line drew a subtle reaction from the roughly 20 people sitting in the audience. Most appeared to be there in support of Turley. The trial is scheduled to reconvene Thursday afternoon. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
A new study suggests that the harvests of several popular wild berries are becoming less reliable in many areas of the state. As KIYU's Tim Bodoni reports, the study is a first step in a process that might learn more about the connections between climate factors and berry production.
Galena schoolteacher Frida Beasley and her husband Howard are fairly prolific berry pickers, sometimes gathering as much as 20 gallons of blueberries and low bush cranberries in a good year. But to Frida, it seems like the good years are getting fewer and farther between.
This year and last year, there were no blueberries. There were no Lobish cranberries. And this year, there's a lot of Lobish cranberries, so we got quite a bit of those.
It turns out that Frida's not alone when it comes to fruitless searches for blueberries recently.
Almost 50% of the people that responded said it had become more variable. There were bigger swings from one year to the next. So it suggests that, yeah, there may be something going on there.
That's research wildlife biologist Jerry Hupp with the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage, one of the authors of the study. Along with researchers from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the University of Alaska Anchorage, Hupp put out a survey to environmental program managers at tribal groups, asking respondents to identify the berries that are commonly harvested in their area and indicate whether the berry harvests seem to be getting larger, smaller, more unpredictable, or staying the same. Hupp cautions that the study does not try to shed light on why berry populations might be rising or falling, but only to document the perceptions of experienced berry pickers.
Our goal was really not so much to try to understand how climate may be influencing berries, you know, how is changes in snow cover or changes in precipitation changing berry abundance. It was more to simply ask people, are you seeing changes? Are there things happening on the ground that might indicate things are different now than they were in previous decades?
Two berries stand out as both commonly harvested and increasingly variable, lowbush blueberries and cloudberries. The perceived decline of blueberries is most pronounced along the western and northern coasts of Alaska, where 76% of respondents experienced lower blueberry harvests or more variability in harvests from year to year. Hupp says that other researchers could expound upon the study to learn more about the science behind berry productivity and get a better sense of how changes in climate might affect berry populations into the future.
Monitoring studies that would examine relationships between environmental variables and berry production, experimental studies that might alter things like snow cover or precipitation, and measure the response of berry species to that.
The study is published in the International Journal of Circumpolar Health. In Galena, I'm Tim Bodoni.
Indigenous, a play on the word indigenous, is an offering of afternoon workshops at the First Alaskan Institute's Elder and Youth Conference this week. 2 years ago, the Siri Foundation helped FAI acquire more funding for the workshops, which include storytelling, drum making, and weaving. Conference participants had asked in previous years for more opportunities to connect and learn through art. Emily Tyrell is the sustainability director for the First Alaskans Institute. She says it's important for young people to embrace their culture's strengths.
Oftentimes we hear this message that our people are overloaded with these terrible statistics, you know, high suicide rates, domestic violence. Yes, those statistics are true, but there is also a message that we bring forward through our work that we are a beautiful, vibrant people, and we've been on these lands for the last 10,000 years.
Susan Anderson, president and CEO of the Siri Foundation, says the idea is that traditional arts give elders and youth the chance to talk about current issues and concerns in the context of an activity their ancestors also took part in.
It's about helping people know who they are culturally and through heritage, as well as helping them to then succeed in their educational path.
One of the first agreements attendees at the annual Elders and Youth Conference make is to participate. In every chair, a leader is a mantra repeated throughout by Institute staff. Attending Ingenious workshops is a step toward fulfilling the mantra. There are dozens of workshops to choose from, and Tyrell says the general public is encouraged and welcome to attend the conference, which runs through Wednesday morning. In a dystopian future, Western civilization has crumbled and indigenous people are in control. That's the premise of Jack Dalton's play Assimilation, now touring Alaska. It flips the history of boarding schools with whites violently assimilated into native culture. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
With each time that you choose to speak your dirty language, your punishment will increase.
A tyrannical character known as Elder pinches a student by the ear and leads him to his desk. In the course of the play, the boys are beaten, verbally abused, and stripped of their identity. Whites are forced to assimilate into Yupik culture. It's horrific treatment, But it also really happened, which playwright Jack Dalton says is the point.
Being Native myself, being Yupik myself, I have had a lot of conversations with people who essentially ask, why are Native people still having problems? And my answer is usually, well, when you look at all of the traumas that happened over several generations, you can imagine that it's really hard to heal from those traumas.
Assimilation premiered in Anchorage in 2010 with 12 sold-out performances. And this past spring, it was selected for a staged reading at Emory University. Dalton said he didn't do any historical research on Alaskan Native boarding schools. He drew inspiration from the stories his family told him about their own experiences.
So I was actually worried that maybe I was too close to the subject and I might be making it harsher than it really was. But my dramaturg, Michael Evenden from Emory University, went and did the research and came back to me and said, you only cover about 25% of what happened.
I do not care how good your Inuktitut is. I do not care how good your Yupik is.
Louise Leonard, the actress who plays Elder, attended one of the Native boarding schools when she was a kid and remembers being punished for speaking her native language, Chupik.
I am so glad that this is going to be on, you know, because we never really talked about those days.
Dalton cast Leonard after meeting her at a state fair. He says traditionally, not talking about the bad things was a survival mechanism. But it's one that can be dangerous. Each performance of assimilation is followed by a community discussion. But Dalton has wondered if some of the material could be offensive, particularly the racial slurs targeted towards whites.
Every single person I talked to said, how could I possibly be offended by what's in the play when you realize that every one of those things and every one of those slurs is something that's happened to Native people and other minorities.
By flipping the roles, Dalton says he hopes Natives won't feel triggered by the violence, and non-Natives can empathize with what happened. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And finally tonight, we have a correction. Yesterday, we reported on Governor Walker signing a proclamation calling October 12th Indigenous Peoples Day. That designation applied only to this year, not future years. That would require a new statute. The governor's office does not plan currently to introduce such legislation. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Unalaska, Rachel Waldholtz and Jennifer Canfield in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Homer, Lisa Fu and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.